Hello, everyone. I'm Robbie Dorman, and this is the Serial Fanassist, the podcast for fans of everything. Welcome. Today, I'm joined by Andrew Bloom of theandrewblog.net to discuss the podcast S-Town, roughly a year after its release. One of the most popular podcasts ever, Andrew and I discuss it thoroughly. We talk about how it defies classification, about its strange subject, John B. McLemore, and how it stretches the bounds of what a podcast is. A fair warning, there are spoilers within, if you haven't listened to it. It was a great talk with Andrew, as always. On to the discussion! Hello, everyone. I'm here, once again, with Andrew Bloom from theandrewblog.net. Andrew, how are you doing?
I'm doing very well. I'm cherishing the number of butterflies that are in my local burg. How about you, Robbie?
Oh, right. I don't have, like, a ready reference to the podcast to talk about how something positive about the endless negativity that McLemore espoused, I suppose. Hi, guys. Hey, out there. This is a podcast about a podcast.
Dog.
We're going to talk about S-Town. It's about a year old at this point. And you should be happy, Andrew. You're the one who finally got me to listen to it.
I take that as a point of pride.
Because I've resisted. I think primarily one I saw from the makers of Serial, and I went, no, thank you. And I also got, you know, the most popular podcast ever since Serial, and blah, I'm like, oh God, if it's that popular, it has to be bad. That's my rule of thumb. Of course, that's
nothing
not true.
Nothing popular is good.
Yeah,
that's
nothing.
Why The Simpsons is so terrible.
Yeah, exactly. It's a dumb reasoning, but I don't know. I'm very precious about my podcasts. So that's also, I think, a point of contention. But you're
in the biz.
Right. The business. That is correct. Unfortunately, I'm in the business of podcasting. I don't know where to start with this thing because I don't know if it's purposefully a like genre-less or not, because it wears a lot of costumes, it wears a lot of masks, it pretends to be a lot of different things at different times through the episodes, but I don't know I would necessarily call it any of those things. Like, it's not really a mystery, like not a typical mystery, because it certainly asks multiple questions through the little journey, but it never really goes out of its way to like answer them. They kind of abandon multiple questions throughout. It's not quite a biography, even though I think it's mostly a biography. I wouldn't call it news. It's not journalism. I mean, it's sort of journalism.
It's journalism. I think it's a form of journalism.
That's a little bit of a stretch for me. I think it started out as journalism, but what it eventually became, I wouldn't call this journalism. All right. I would call it art, but I would not call it journalism.
Do you listen or have you listened to This American Life on?
I have listened to This American Life.
Do you consider that journalism generally?
Sometimes.
So I think it's the same kind of thing. I think it's a form of journalism. It's not pure news reporting, but I think profiles, and I would consider this a very wide-ranging profile. I consider that journalism.
Okay, let's circle back around to that, because I have
this is the important part.
It's a bigger I have some sticking points that I would hesitate to call it true journalism, but there is definitely reporting going on here, an investigation and stuff like that. The effort of Brian Reed and whoever else is involved. I don't know if he did this because he lists off a long list of people in those credits in every episode. But is he the only person actually contacting everyone in Alabama and all that? I assume he was, but I'm not sure.
I imagine there was a lot of under the decks work that took place in terms of both people who were doing fact checking, people who were doing interviews and laying the groundwork before Brian got into it. I imagine there were a lot of recorded conversations and contacts that we didn't necessarily get every detail of that had other staffers do. But he was certainly the face of it, if nothing else, so to speak, for a podcast.
Yes. The voice of the podcast.
It's a much better metonym.
I don't know. I was looking around at critical thought on this thing, and that the genre seemed to be widely varied depending on who was writing the piece.
Well, let me ask you this question. At a very broad level, what do you think S-Town is about? Regardless of what genre it fits into, what do you think this podcast, this 7 episodes of radio or audio, whatever you want to consider it, what do you think that they are ultimately about? That's the noise that presages a cheery answer.
It's the question I've struggled with, honestly. Like, I read your piece, and it's well written as always.
Thank you. You are too kind, as always.
I certainly think your reading is valid. I just don't know if I agree. Because you basically say, oh, it's about how everyone contains multitudes. Nothing is simple. And
I do think that's at least a strong theme of it, if not the sum total of it.
And I think if I was going to say it's about anything, it is about John B. McLemore and about the fact that this incredibly unique man lived his whole life in shit town, as he would call it. And if there wasn't for this, his life would have gone uninvestigated and he would have been a blip. You know, he would have been another person in this small town. Everyone in the town knows of him. And all these weirdos, the horologists and his assembled friends over the years, they would remember him vaguely or distinctly, depending on how well they knew him.
But, I would say distinctly whether you knew him well or not, but...
Yeah. He is, like, his person... That's the thing, like, I guess that's what it is. It is a piece about him, and I don't feel comfortable saying anything more about it besides that, because I think that's my largest complaint about the podcast, is that I think it's well crafted. I think that the man himself is very, very compelling. I don't find him likable, but I do find him compelling. But it felt like the thing itself was resisting any effort to categorize it or even establish a theme in it. It felt like the theme of this podcast was we had to hastily change what this was 7 different times.
So I would push back on that a little bit. I think every individual episode has a pretty clear theme, and I'll accept that they don't necessarily amount together to one cohesive thesis, but I think that every individual episode, and occasionally a segment within an episode, has a larger theme and a larger point to it, and that Brian Reed and the team of S-Town is trying to lay out a mosaic in that effect. But I also do think there is a larger theme and a larger point to it. And I tease this out a little bit in the piece that I wrote, but I do think it's about the ever-changing connections and intricacies that pull these people's lives together. You talk about the craft of the podcast. One of the things it does very well is putting you in the shoes and the perspective and giving you the sympathies of a particular side of the story. I'm going to assume that we're full spoilers here.
Oh yeah, absolutely. This is if you haven't listened, go listen if you haven't before. If you care, some people don't care, but most people I think would. So go listen to it and come back if you are concerned.
Well, on that, I think it sets you up expecting in many ways at the beginning of the podcast that maybe there is no murder. Maybe this whole thing is a wild goose chase. And then it gives you some kind of confirmation that it is and pulls you back and forth on that path for a long time. Then when it settles that, it teases into this sense of the unraveledness that happened after John McLemore passed away. And it gives you Tyler Goodson and it gives you the cousins and it puts your sympathies on both sides. And it feels like every time, I think if there's a larger theme, a larger point to the podcast, it's trying to make the viewer think and feel one thing, or pardon me, the listener think and feel one thing, and then gives them the other side of it, or gives them something that complicates it and shows how easy it is to latch on to one part of something and not see the greater whole. And I think that S-Town is ultimately a podcast about trying to see the greater whole and at the same time acknowledging in a way that John McLemore really struggled with, that that whole is bigger and more complex and more gnarly and knotty than we can ever conceive of. And it gives us reason to treat these situations with sympathy and empathy and understanding, ultimately. I will take your sigh to mean that you don't fully agree, right?
I mean, I agree with that sentiment. I agree that it is incredibly complicated. Anyone, any single person, no man is an island, et cetera, et cetera. It's an incredibly complicated story, and any one perspective is flawed. And I think that perspective, I think that certainly comes across in the podcast. Like, obviously, you can't trust any of these people. They're all, even if they are all telling the truth, which I think no one is telling the truth in this thing, even if they are, because of their limited perspective, because of the way that they live and the way they are grow up and the way they're they were nurtured, etc., it limits their perspective and gives them a limited range that they are unable to present any more of their life than what they do in their interviews.
That's true. They're all pieces of the whole, though. They are all the gears and the pulleys and the levers in the clock that get put together and tied together to make this unusual, intricate, beautiful, weird thing that is both John B. McLemore's life and Woodstock, Alabama, and this whole woolly world that we find ourselves in.
I acknowledge, use the word beautiful, Andrew.
I did.
Okay.
Not to go all, not to be too presidential about it.
I understand. I think the name of this podcast, S-Town, is terrible because Shittown is a way better name. I understand they're NPR and they got to be sensitive, but man, Shittown, if someone told me you got to listen to this podcast, it's called Shittown, I immediately would have gone and listened to it. But when someone says, oh, it's named S-Town, I'm like, what does that mean?
I don't disagree, but I think I am willing to bow to the demands of commerce that say we'd like for this podcast to be successful. And Brian Reed refers to it as Shittown on when you listen to the actual podcast. And it's pretty hard to do advertisements or anything on actual public radio without getting massive fines from the FCC.
I know. It's just it is not only my complaint about the title, it is my complaint about a lot of the things in this thing where it gets very close to the edge of it. Like, it shows, like, I really enjoy, there's a particular section early on when the idea that there could have been a murder is still present before that's been dispelled and forgotten. I forget who exactly it was. I don't know if it was Tyler or one of the other associated rednecks that are interviewed and then are also mostly forgotten. Who say
new band named Associated Rednecks?
Yeah, they're talking about it was detailing the party out in the woods and then someone gets stabbed in the neck and then another dude gets beaten. And, you know, they're, who, does anyone die? No, no one died. And no one pressed charges. And they're like, why would you not press charges after your friend almost gets, like, almost dies, gets stabbed in the neck? And they're like, oh, well, when you associate with low down, dirty people, you know, it's just kind of the way you live. Like, if you're, like, living, like, they use the words white trash. And if you're living, like, you can't be surprised when low down, dirty shit happens when you're hanging out with low down, dirty people. And if anything, I felt like, that story is exciting to me. And certainly there's a lot of low down, dirty stuff happening in this story. And it dips its toes there once in a while, and then it kind of backs away. And it has this slight remove of, no, we don't want to do that. No, we're not going to dig into the dirtiness of this. We're removed.
I disagree with that. I think it embraces pretty wholeheartedly and two-handedly the difficulties of the place that John McLemore emerges from, both in terms of that little bit that you get of, you know, Cabram Burt and his life and his experiences, but you get a lot of it through Tyler, and they try to put the best face they can on Tyler to some degree. And I think Brian Reed himself says Tyler has had very different life experiences than Brian Reed has, and then that I would presume you and I have, Robbie. And I think one of the nice things about the show is that it approaches these things from a non-judgmental standpoint, but I don't think it shies away from them either, even if it's not necessarily about the dark underbelly of Woodstock, Alabama. It doesn't shy away from the fact that there's a unnerving amount of KKK graffiti on a bridge that he finds, or that Tyler thinks it's fair and just to cut off the fingers of somebody he believes to have stolen from him. I will admit it's not the central focus of it, but I don't think it's hidden away either. And it's one of the things I appreciate about the podcast is it gives you a piece of everything in some way that not only made Woodstock, Alabama what it is, but made John B. McLemore who he is. And that is an understandably sprawling project, perhaps one that, if we're being critical, is difficult to condense within 7 roughly hour-long episodes. But I also don't think it puts that to the side either.
I mean, I think it's too short, frankly, for what it's trying to do also. But that's a lower minor quibble. I would have cut things that were, I think, I would consider extraneous and keep it the same length versus extend it to 10 or 15 episodes or something. But, okay, I don't know if I've ever asked you this, Andrew, on or off the air. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Dallas, Texas area.
Okay.
In a suburb of Dallas.
Suburb? Okay.
Yes.
I grew up in rural Florida in a place that is not too unlike Woodstock, Alabama. My childhood home that my parents are finally leaving this year, thank God, they are finally leaving my childhood home, was down a mile and a half of dirt road, twists and turns, snakes, it defies GPS directions, just like McLemore's house does. You lead people back there. You do not say, here's our address. You say, meet me at the top of the hill, and you follow me back. And that's how you get there. Until you drive enough times, then you know the way. There are times during hurricanes in Florida, we could not leave because the roads would be washed out. Or we had to take other dirt roads that would lead to other exits. I lived, the nearest paved road was called Forest Road 8. I assume because it was the 8th one. I don't know why they called it. It has a proper street name now, but when I was a child, it was Forest Road 8. I still know tons of people like Tyler and all those people. When he went to that tattoo shop, and, you know, he's hanging out with a bunch of hillbillies, and there's one fat guy who has Feed Me tattooed on his belly. I knew dudes like that. I could practically recognize, I could see them without their visual description. Like, I knew exactly who those dudes were. Like, I saw pictures of Tyler finally. I looked it up after I listened to the thing. I'm like, he looks exactly like I imagine him to be.
Well, maybe that's some of our disconnect, is that I probably despite, you know, growing up in the South or whatever unique thing Texas is, I probably come from more of the background that Brian Reed came from, which may color my view of his podcast.
I think it, and it's a thing I acknowledge. I am biased. I think obviously everyone's biased.
Well, we're all biased. We're both biased. We're all everyone biased in different directions.
Exactly. And it's a thing that I've struggled a lot with in, like, listening to me, most people would not think I'm from rural Florida, from a place that isn't a town. But because my parents were from the north, I don't have an accent, really. I'm sure there's certain words that I move in different directions. Probably Philadelphia, New Jersey is the closest accent I'd have on certain words. But largely, I don't, I am from rural Florida. I consider myself Southern in some ways. And in the wake of Trump's victory and the way that news outlets have spent so much time going, like, interviewing Trump voters in blue state and like in going after the aggrieved Southern person who for some reason voted Trump, you know, for whatever reason they had, and romanticizing that whole idea of coal, you know, old coal workers. I had a neighbor whose entire family were coal workers. They're all dead from black lung. He was the only one left. While I knew him.
Sorry to hear that.
I mean, I didn't like the man, so I mean, it's not. He was not a great person, but I think is part of my resonance is like this romanticization of these small Southern towns, these rural Southern towns, where when Macklemore is starting his that spiel in the beginning, back when I still liked him, before the layers were unveiled, the onion was peeled back. When he starts talking about how there's so few schools, so many churches, talks about how the local lumber king, whose companies are all called KKK something.
And K3, no, yeah, I think, to be fair.
Okay.
I mean, I didn't say anything. I'm just saying.
I'm saying something that man is a white supremacist because I knew
he
many.
Certainly was not anxious to deny the charge.
Exactly. I knew many men like him in my time in rural Florida, who when you ask what they feel about, they would, you know, smile and nod and change the subject or make fun of you. It's this romanticization of these places of, I think when you say they contain multitudes and you call it beautiful, there are certainly good people who live in these places.
There is beauty in it if it is not wholly beautiful.
I agree. There are still certain things I liked about living where I lived. I mostly didn't like it and left as soon as I possibly could, which is a thing I tell my father when he's finally leaving now, 35 years later. I just can't see much charm when they paint Tyler as a complicated man. I'm sure he is complicated because everyone is. And when they paint Woodstock, that is largely, I feel like, done in the last two episodes, maybe even the last one. Where
pretty much just the last one, I would say. To a little extent earlier, but for the most part, the last one.
Right, yeah. Brian Reed, he kind of like tries to interview people who live in the town and like it. They're like, yeah, we like it here. I like this and this and this and this about this town. But he never interjects and says, oh, actually, I like the fact that there was a Rolling Stone article I read about how the racism that is basically omnipresent, it is touched upon once or twice. I think twice is my count.
They certainly address the racism in there. I think Brian is taken aback by it. And it's certainly like S-Town is not about this, but it certainly includes these things, I would say.
I mean, I think it is those. It's just those things, the racism, the homophobia, which the homophobia in particular, which is a different subject altogether. But I can forgive certain parts of the racism. It's just it made me when Brian that whole bit maybe that's it. It just feels at times extraordinarily naive. The his reactions to people using the N-word, and I
think it is, but I also think that's part of the point, that this is not something that Brian Reed experiences on a regular basis, and B, it's probably not something that a lot of NPR listeners experience on a regular basis. And I'll accept that there's something a little uneasy about this sort of radio tourism of these places that a lot of NPR listeners would never go in that. But at the same time, I think that's part of what these kinds of programs and art generally exists to do, to let us set foot in these places that we might never otherwise set foot in the same way that John McLemore considered himself a citizen of the world, despite the fact that he felt very confined to Woodstock, Alabama. And I guess I at least feel like the podcast is very honest about that, even if it is – I don't think you're wrong in saying that Brian Reed is naive when he's going into these places and being kind of shocked by these things.
Think of all the stereotypical dumb redneck stuff that people lump on Southerners. And I think largely that's unfair because the South is a huge area and it does contain multitudes. There's lots of very complicated things happening in the South. And I know a lot of people don't think rural Florida as the South, but rural Florida is as South as you can get. But there were, like, I can't detail you my entire life growing up of the insane things that people did back there. Dangerous, awful, terrible things that we witnessed. Everything, every time that Brian Reed goes, clutches his pearls, oh no, they use the N-word in front of me. I'm like, dude, that's nothing. That's like drinking water. That's nothing. Were you partial to people openly threatening black men in your person? Oh, no, and never? Oh, okay. It's just the layers, like, it's a problem to me of depth of people using the N-word, where people like going, black people, well, like the whole welfare queen garbage, which they allude to, I believe, in the same tattoo shop segment. Like, that's nothing. That's the lightest layer of racism.
So did you want the podcast to be more about the kind of pathologies of these places? Because I think you get a lot of that through John, and I know he's not a reliable narrator, but you at least have those ideas present. Or is it B, did you want it to be more condemning of those things? Did you want it to retreat from its kind of non-judgmental stance about a lot of these things and be more open and clear about what's wrong with some of the community, or at least parts of the culture of a place like Woodstock, Alabama?
I don't know. I think that's why it has to be longer. It has to be shorter. Because including here's these people and they're racists. Like, okay, I know they are. They live in Woodstock, Alabama. I know, like, it doesn't matter because they grew up there. They can't help it. In some cases.
But there's a difference between knowing that intellectually the way that most people do and knowing it more specifically and individually through people actually doing things in the way that, you know, is an experience you have and I don't have, at least in the same degree. I think that's what they're getting at there. I know This American Life has done very recently a podcast about a different small town in Alabama and the racist attitudes that were omnipresent and the effect of immigration on it. And it's, you know, two episodes, not seven episodes, but dug in multitude of ways on about making a podcast about that. I think that S-Town is a podcast of that, but not about that. It's about John McLemore, and the environment he grew up in is obviously relevant to that and obviously meaningful as to what this guy's life was and what his existence was and the thing that he was constantly railing against. But I think it's okay for it not to be about that and not to explore it with the same commitment that it does what was making this guy tick.
Well, let's talk about John McLemore.
Seems reasonable.
It seems reasonable. It is. He's the primary subject of this podcast. Of both, technically. Of two podcasts. I mean, I'm sure there's other people who've done podcasts about S-Town. I think NPR or Fox or Vulture or somebody, they did their own podcast about the this about S-Town. So now we are another podcast that's about a podcast, which is
S-Town Town.
S-Town Town, or Talking S-Town, as it would be called.
The S-Town Breakdown.
Yeah, there you go. Rhyme. Rhyme is good. I find, I wish, that, and that's another thing I wish, I don't, like, they leave, I think it is a, it is the things that I want out of this podcast are victim of the situation about how, in which it was produced. Because it feels to me, and I don't know if this has ever been confirmed or denied anywhere, feels very much like to me that Brian Reed went down, was chasing this lead about this murder, turns out, finds eventually that it's not real, or it's the circumstances are vastly different. And in that process, starts talking with Macklemore. And I don't know if what they'd have would be called a friendship. They had a relationship, I suppose. Like, they talked to each other.
I think you'd call it a friendship. I would call it a friendship.
I'm not sure if... I hesitate to use the word friendship because that's a part of the podcast, and they go like, where Macklemore himself says, I don't have any friends. They're all dead. And then other people disagree with him. They're like, yeah, he's my friend. And that's my hesitance, is that from Macklemore's point of view, it feels like he is, like, I don't know how to judge any relationship he had.
It's true, but I think part of the thrust of the podcast is that Macklemore is in some ways blind to what was around him and self-pitying to the point of imagining that he didn't have these connections when he really did. Somebody says partway through the podcast, like, I think John, was somebody who only imagined himself to be lonely or thought himself to be lonely. And Brian Reed raises the point that maybe there's not much of a difference between actually being lonely and thinking you're lonely. But I at least think he's somebody who felt alienated, but who was also loved and cared for. And maybe friendship isn't a one-way ratchet. Maybe it doesn't work that way. But I think John Macklemore had friends, whether he acknowledged it or not.
I think I only bring up that it seems like a product of he learns that Macklemore has killed himself. And then in after finding it out and going to the funeral and seeing all these layers unveil themselves, he continues this journey. Ryan.
He follows the story.
Right.
Where it takes him.
Exactly. But I'm curious what is left. I think it is another complaint I have. It's just, it feels like for a story about a man, it feels like the podcast obfuscates a lot of things about him. And I don't feel like I even now I have a clear picture of what his life was like. He lived in this town and he lived in this weird estate and he took care of his mom probably poorly. And he was a weirdo and kind of misanthropic to be kind.
I think kind of is putting it gently.
No, to be kind, I'm calling him misanthropic. I mean, he's hateful at times, openly hateful. But I still don't have a sense of the man. I still don't know what he is. I feel like your conclusion that, people are complicated is the only thing you can bring from it, because I don't have anything else. Like, is it because it's messy in that the, like, they introduced the fact very late in the podcast, and it kind of boggled my mind when it happened, when Brian Reed's discussing the fact that, John probably had probably heavy doses of mercury poisoning, and that has the effect of driving people insane, and that might be why he's turned into kind of a misanthropic, hate-filled person in his later years. And I'm like, you introduced this now? This is the last episode. This is important.
Well, yeah, but I don't have a problem with that. I feel like every episode of the podcast is peeling back some layer of John Macklemore. And I'm not going to say that what we get in the last episode is the core of who he is, because while I think the show does try to put some kind of final button or final point on that, what its thesis is, I think it's more about that there are all these layers to him, and that is one of them. One that Brian Reed can't be sure of, because he's not a doctor and nobody can investigate medically what it would take to prove that one way or another. He gives you the elements. He gives you the parts of this person and lets you put them together in the way that you think makes the most sense. I know that there is something messy and something complicated about that. I think it's intentional. I think it's from a specific desire to continue showing those layers and show that it is a difficult thing to get to know somebody, because we live such complicated, in some ways long lives that make it hard to fully know somebody in 7 episodes or in 70 episodes.
I mean, again, it's not that the podcast is ever wrong. Like, it never presents wrong. I think in that case, like, using the word journalism, I think is accurate, because it feels like the podcast does present truthful information when Brian knows it's the truth. And when he's unsure of something, he presents it that way. He presents, I am not confident in this. All I know is that, yes, this incredibly bright man also continued to perform this incredibly dumb procedure to make sure that the clocks were recreated correctly with the right parts that would give him mercury poisoning over the years. Which, true, he did that. People witnessed it. How much did it affect him? Who knows? It certainly feels like it explains a lot of his change in behavior as he got more, as he exposed himself to more and more mercury. And it seems like
this maybe, but as Reed himself points out, there was also a lot of real life difficulty that John faced around the same time that, you know, completely independent of any chemical issue or combined with a brain chemical issue, could have sent anybody into at least a change in their view of the world and their approach to the world.
It's true. But I think that we, as a society, discount environmental factors too quickly. And I mean, environmental, not in how a person is sociologically raised, but I mean, literally physical accumulation of weird chemicals. And hey, I grew up close to a chemical plant, or every morning at the farm, I would use pesticides in the 60s or something, which had some bad things in them. Whatever. I feel like we discount that stuff too often.
I don't disagree with you, but I also think it would be irresponsible for NPR or This American Life or Brian Reed, as somebody who is not an expert, even as somebody who consulted experts, as the explanation for why John is the way he is.
That's fair. You use the word irresponsible, and it's I can have my criticisms of the story arc or whatever as much as I want, but those are largely immaterial, because that I think that largely accumulates to I, because of the way I grew up and et cetera, I didn't like this thing. It's not that it's bad. It's just I didn't like it. I think my question for you is, there is a certain point that in this thing, and this is, I think, the greatest point of contention in all the criticism I read about it,
mm-hmm.
Was the large portion of this podcast takes place after John is dead. The second episode ends with the news that John has committed suicide, and then we have 5 episodes of this assemblage, what was the word you used?
Mosaic.
That's the word you used. It's the
collage.
Collage. That's another good one.
It's all a rich tapestry.
Tapestry. Oh, quilt. That's not as good. But a quilt is that. That's what a quilt is.
It is.
But the people don't use that word to mean that. Why? English. And there is a point in, I forget which episode it is. I think it's 5 or 6 where it is entirely is examining John as a queer man, as a homosexual.
Yeah, it's episode 6.
Okay, episode 6. Living in rural Alabama and how he made that, how that worked for him, how his life was not, I don't know about centered, but certainly a large part of his life was being this a gay man in rural Alabama, where socially it is like those people can talk about all they want about, I knew he was that way, I just didn't care, et cetera, et cetera. That's his business. Because there is a point where, and Brian Reed even points this out, where he has a he's talking to John in the car as they're doing chores or errands or whatever, and
picking up a pizza.
Yeah, that's right, Little Caesars or whatever.
It's important.
Oh man, I've been there. When that's your options. Yeah, you want pizza? Little Caesars. That's what you get.
I liked the Little Caesars when I was a kid. I haven't had in a very long time, and I mean, don't know if I would have the same reaction.
I'll eat Little Caesars. I'll eat most pizza. There's very little pizza I won't eat, and Little Caesars is definitely above the line,
the threshold
of eatable pizza. Little Caesars is fine, and it's cheap too, so you can get a bunch of it, which makes up for the badness. You just go, oh well, I mean, it's not as good, but it's a lot of pizza, so there's that. I can eat bad pizza for 3 days. But when John and it tells him turn off the recorder, and it is a part of me that hesitates to call this journalism when it includes things that are technically off the record.
Okay, so I think there's three points here, and let's take them from broadest to most specific. The first is the question of whether or not it's ethical to do this radio program about somebody who has passed away, which means that there's no way that John could give his full consent to the final product. He doesn't have his final sign-off. That said, I do think I'll say I think I'm okay with that, and I feel pretty categorical about it. To Brian Reed's point, and I think you get this in things that John himself says in the podcast that I don't remember specifically, so don't quote me on it. John didn't believe in an afterlife, so I don't think there's any way in which he thinks he would be harmed by it. But I also think that you see throughout the podcast both that John is somebody who is very open, who is not at all shy about talking to complete strangers with the sort of candidness that at least I would have a very difficult time mustering, but also somebody who seemed to want to be heard, who seemed to have things to say and to put out there about himself and his perceptions and his experiences, to where, if nothing else, I don't feel like it violates the spirit of who John McLemore was to share this part of his life openly. Whether or not he's around to give his stamp of approval on the resulting podcast and sort of do line item vetoes, I at least think that the way that we witness John McLemore's life, the way that we witness how open he is about what he thinks and who he is, this podcast doesn't seem to violate his privacy in any way, because I feel like he was pretty open with it as a general matter. The second point is one where I feel less confident being categorical, because it's very easy for me as a heterosexual man who has never had to deal with the difficulties of whether or not to be open about his sexuality, to cast any judgment one way or another on what is okay or what isn't okay. But I will say from my perspective that independently of episode 6 of the podcast, there's several instances in S-Town in which John McLemore himself says on the record that he is a homosexual man. He may couch it in sort of odd ways. He may refer to himself as, you know, I've been on both sides of the line, or, you know, reference that everybody thinks he is this way. But I don't think he made a secret of the fact that he harbored these feelings, that this was his sexual orientation. And so I am at least not myself bothered by it. That said, I fully acknowledge that it's a complicated question, and it's maybe not the right question that for people to take my opinion as the gospel truth on, given where I sit and the things that I don't have to face in it. But to your third point about something that he talks about that isn't on the record, I think Reed does a good job of covering his tracks there. He says that John was worried about, not that he had done this thing, but seemingly about the identity of the person whom he had slept with. And Reed takes great pains not to reveal the identity of that person. And as for the information itself, it's the information he received from other people on the record. So I think I can only very, very, very tenuously be called the journalist, but I think it meets the ethical standards that I would impose on this sort of thing.
I think
that was a lot.
I mean, it's not my, like, me. I agree largely with what you just said. I think it is never a, I never go, oh, this is wrong. But there are multiple points in this where I go, this feels gross. And that is a different thing altogether. Like, not that you're, like, there is a really good article, and this is the one that, after reading this, I was largely like, yeah, it's fine. It felt a little gross, but it's fine. But then Atlantic wrote a really good article back when it came out, S-Town originally came out, titled, Was the Art of S-Town Worth the Pain? And it alludes to another piece of art, a collection of poetry written by Robert Lau,
mm-hmm.
who wrote a collection of poetry called The Dolphin. And there's a fellow poet named Elizabeth Bishop. She was friends with Robert Lau, and they were friends of, they were colleagues, friends, and their partners were friends. They, as their husbands and wives, they would go on trips together. But eventually Robert Lau, his wife left him because he cheated on her and various levels of, I don't know, pain and whatever. This is pretty well documented of the things he did. But she wrote him letters about ending their relationship, about how much pain he had caused her. And then he took those letters and put them in his book of poetry, used them at some point, like word for word, and then oftentimes changed them and just used them. And he's like, and Elizabeth Bishop wrote to him and said, and wrote a little small essay about why would you do this? That this art is not worth it. And his response was, this book is nothing without those letters. And he understands, yes, I understand that this is bad, but I'm still doing it because the art is worth something. I think the art is worth the pain. And when you first asked me, like, what I felt about this, after I told you, oh, I finished, and I said, it's a mystery box filled with pain. A pain of a man. Of John. And this in particular, this part, and the last two episodes, primarily, of his various homosexual relationships as a semi-closeted man in rural Alabama, and of his relationship with tattoos and piercings. Both of those episodes, it made me look at those episodes in a different way and made me go, the fact that both of these last two, like, it is sad, but the fact that he is dead and can't say no, like, yes or no, yes, please release a biography about me and talk about how much pain I went through as a man. I don't want to say it's wrong, but it feels at times very gross. And I don't think that John would care if there was an NPR podcast that said he was gay, because you're right, in multiple recordings, he's like, yeah, I'm gay, I'm this, I'm that. You know, he has his turns of phrases, and they're very unique and are vulgar. I appreciate his frankness, and at least in those cases. But it's when you get to that other dude in rural Alabama, and he's never identified, but he is, and he's not, his audio isn't used. But Woodstock is an incredibly small town. And when you start doing things, when you start putting that stuff out there, part of me goes, that's a little, that dude didn't say, yeah, it's okay to include this hearsay about me being gay.
Presumably he spoke on the record. Otherwise, I don't think he would have. I mean, maybe I'm wrong. I could be wrong.
I imagine he
spoke on the record with Brian, or else Brian wouldn't have relayed his conversations with that guy.
Well, I mean, I don't think the conversations he had with that guy and him going, no, I ain't gay. Of course not. Blah, blah, blah. I don't know. Maybe I'm just putting too much credence into John's word. But if anything, it felt very much like John always told his version of the truth. I never felt to me that he was purposefully lying. although I, which is not what I would not share that with either any of the cousins or with Tyler. It felt like they were always telling a very specific version of the truth and purposely omitting things. John, obviously limited perspective of a single man, I always felt like he was being honest, even if it was ugly. It feels exploitative. And when you do that about a dead man, it brings me back around to this question I wrote down, is like, how do I judge this thing? Because this is a unique thing. It is a podcast that there's nothing like it. It is like suddenly so popular all of a sudden because it is incredibly novel. And we don't have a roadmap set out for what this is.
But I also think that it's popular because it is moving and it's affecting and it's honest. And I acknowledge there is a risk of exploitativeness here. If there is an unease that I have with the podcast, it's to your point that it fits it into the mystery box setup. That Brian Reed is a storyteller, and he tells this story in a very particular way to keep you on the hook, to keep you ready to listen to the next episode. There is something a little uneasy about that for me. But I also think that what separates the project of the podcast from something like Robert Lau's poetry is I think his heart is in the right place. I think he comes to this with empathy for John, with the idea that there is something to be celebrated about this man and something to be understood in him. And maybe he's not the person who gets to make that call. I am willing to accept that. And I can, if somebody wants to take issue with the podcast on those grounds, I am at least sympathetic to it. But I think he presents these things not to titillate or to thrill or to shock, but because he thinks they're necessary parts of understanding who this man is and that this man is worth understanding. That makes me a lot more at ease about the bigger project of S-Town than I might otherwise be.
I think here's my final point of contention. And this is my only problem with the actual reporting, and not a question of ethics or a question of construction of arc or whatever. That last episode talks a lot about church, of Tyler and John's church sessions, where we find out how and why John was getting tattooed and getting piercings, nipple piercings, as talked about in multiple times in the podcast, including removing nipple rings, which, okay, great.
I couldn't believe that was accurate.
I
assumed that was a Tyler tall tale, and then
yeah, there I don't, you go. I don't, I think the yeah. Anyway. And it is the other point where I go, that it is the only point in which Brian's quote unquote naivete starts to border into, it feels like relying on coming back to a story arc versus the truth. And if there are multiple people involved in piercing and in tattoo, and like they talk a lot about pain and a lot about how this is John working through things and how Tyler was a partner in this. You know, he would pierce him, he would tattoo him, and you listen to the audio of it. You hear John like getting a high off of it. Sometimes bordering, it feels like, on sexual release, sexual pleasure. And then you start calling it, you relate it to cutting and self-harm. Those are very different things. Incredibly different things. And I don't expect this podcast, like you said, I know I shouldn't expect it to go deep on racism, and I know it shouldn't go deep on like BDSM pathology and all that stuff. But I can easily see this, like they go in depth about John's relationships and John's relationship primarily with Tyler and how he's a father figure to Tyler. And they both say that and multiple times.
Mm-hmm.
And other people say it. And they talk about how, and they hunt down that guy in New York who fulfilled a similar role to John much earlier in his life.
Michael Fuller, I think his name is. It could be mixed up.
I cannot remember it. And they go on and on about how John is reliant on these people, and he kind of has this weird possession of them and ownership of them. And then they go in on, oh yeah, and he would get ritualized piercings. He would get tattoos, even though he espoused hating tattoos. And that is not self-harm. One, it is involving another person, which makes it inherently safer. Because for everything Tyler was, he was also a professional tattoo artist and piercer. So that makes it safe. Mm-hmm. That makes it... I would not get tattooed in a shack out in the back. I would get tattooed in a... I have tattoos. I got tattooed in professional tattoo parlor where you get standards of cleanliness. But it's not self-harm. It is not on the same level as someone cutting or hurting themselves in that same way. There are plenty of people who engage in various levels of pain, in various levels, and like, you go to tattoo parlors, there's plenty of people. That is what tattooing is to them. They get tattooed because it feels they like it in a weird way. It brings a high. I think it's that is irresponsible as a journalist to equate those two things, because they're not the same. One is done in a relatively safe environment with other people around, and one is done by yourself and is dangerous and can lead to it's the very fact that Tyler is there is a statement about it. Like, and it, frankly, I think it also fails on connecting them deeper, because that speaks to John's trust in him and that he's involving him in this ritual. And instead of making this ritual something that connects them and ultimately drives John to suicide, it is some weird sick thing that, like, they're always like a weirdo. I'm like, it's not that much of a weirdo. I'm sorry, you're like this white bread vanilla dude who doesn't understand, like, oh no, tattoos. Oh.
Well, okay, so I am a fellow white bread vanilla dude, so I probably have more sympathy for Brian Reed here. I also do not know enough about BDSM to cry foul, but I'm fully accepting of the idea that S-Town should have put this in more context and was quick to judge and could have been irresponsible in equating those two things. I do think it's fair to separate tattooing generally and the practices that John was undergoing with another person or not. That, you know, had being tattooed without the needle, being pierced, being asked to be whipped by his friends. I think it's, I'm not saying right or wrong. I'm not judging it necessarily, but it's at least, I think, distinct from garden variety tattooing. And I think the show kind of implicitly acknowledges that this isn't just about John being tattooed or that tattoos themselves are bad or evil in some way, but that there was something more going on about how John was approaching it, good or bad.
I mean, I agree with you. I just think it actually deepens the story if it is addressed the proper way. Like, there's definitely more layers to the fact that he's having his friends whip him and then he's getting that tattooed on his back. But I think it makes me feel more sorry for him, ultimately. And by portraying him as some weirdo, like, I feel like that is... It is another notch on this is for the dumb, like, innocent white NPR listener who's like, oh my god. it adds to that layer of kind of voyeurism and exploitation to me, because it feels like it's not...
No, I can see that. I can see what you're saying.
It isn't trying to explain these things to people. It just goes, look at this other. Isn't this strange?
Or it does, but I think you make a fair point that it may do so poorly, that the context it tries to put it in is not necessarily fair.
And I mean, it's not like any one of these things is like that is a like the, despite the fact I you know, there's a lot of articles that point that as a big thing and like, look at this crazy realization. But I don't know. It is a minor point that is among a lot of other minor points that weigh down on me. And I think most people would like this. And I obviously most do, because it is amazingly popular. I don't like Serial. I don't like true crime podcasts. I don't like a lot of heavy podcasts. I avoid them largely unless people like rave and rave and rave about them, like you did with this. And eventually I'm like, oh, listen, I'll give it a shot. But largely.
And now you'll never take a piece of my advice again.
That's not true. I don't go to podcasts for this. I go to podcasts like it is a wider topic of NPR podcasts in general. They are very slick, excellently produced, crafted things that take. This took years to make in with the reporting and the editing and the production. But even an episode of This American Life, I'm sure, takes dozens of hours. If you discount the reporting. And the recording part, like the actual editing of piecing and splicing things together, the thing I appreciate most about podcasting is the kind of DIY aspect of it. I did an whole episode about podcasting like a year ago or something on this very podcast. You can go back and listen to it. But I can appreciate the craft that NPR and similar other podcast outlets, Ringer, I think, is a little bit closer to what I appreciate them, but they've sprung up recently because of the success of advertising at podcasts, and that it still works. Advertising in a lot of other places doesn't work as well. Advertising in podcasts is working. It works. It makes people go
pretty captive audience.
People go buy the thing if you advertise a lot of the time, more than in any other medium right now. And with these big companies producing these very slick things, I hesitate to embrace them because I like the quick and dirty aspect of this medium. I like the fact that within an hour of us recording this, this would be out and be listenable. The immediacy of that is really attractive to me. The fact that with a couple mics and a computer, I can record a podcast with anybody on Earth. You know, I can't make a film, like a good one at least, like that. I can't write a book. I can't make a video game. I can't make a TV show like that. But I can record a podcast like that. And it is an issue. Whenever I listen to these things, I'm like, wow, this is really well done. But it took a team of, like, when I was I asked you earlier about the credits. I'm like, how many people do you think were involved in this? Like a dozen, at least, more than that.
I'm sure a whole production team. Yeah.
I don't know. That's not anything to do with this podcast in particular. It's just kind of this genre of podcasts where these very slickly produced stories. And a lot of people love them, obviously. They're all very successful. It's just...
It's not for you. That's okay.
Mostly not for me, I think. I think there's a few odd one here or there that I will appreciate.
Well, I mean, I'll say this. I grew up listening to This American Life. And so I think I'm maybe... accustomed and socialized into the form. And I do appreciate it as a form of journalism, sometimes in a news magazine form, sometimes in a vignette, sometimes as a sort of broader profile, like I think that S-Town is, as a way of getting at deeper things. I think the folks who work for This American Life and its various offshoots have perfected that over the years, and I can appreciate that. And I do appreciate the immediacy of podcasting. I appreciate the ability for you and I to have something that is both conversational and feels like, you know, we're sitting in a living room together having this conversation, but also that allows other people to be a part of it. But I also appreciate something that is more of a production, that is more of taking pieces together and putting them in the best conceivable way that the folks behind the scenes can think to do it. And I think the result of that is something like S-Town, which is, I would say, better than Serial in my book, either season. And better than a wide swath of other works doing the same kind of thing, because it gets an essential empathy, because it plumbs the depths of these intricate connections between individuals, between the connections between who someone is and where they grow up, with how they see themselves in the world. And I really appreciate that. I acknowledge there are questionable things about S-Town. It is by no means perfect, and I think there's room to take issue with some of the things that Brian Reed explores and doesn't explore. But I think it's also very committed to, in a non-judgmental and empathetic fashion, look at who John B. McLemore is and accept it, but also investigate it, with the goal of helping everybody who's listening both to understand this individual person and this individual place, but to have the broader idea that there are those depths and those complications beneath the skin that we're not always privy to. It's a unique story, but I think a valuable one, in my book at least.
I'm debating if I would use the word valuable. I would say yes, probably.
I think it's a piece that encourages the listener to peel back the layers of whatever they're approaching. And I think that is valuable.
I think my concern is that people would listen to this and then take everything in it at face value. The article, it's the question, like, and it, like, a representative fact of that is there's an article, the Rolling Stone article is about racism in S-Town, and it says, it points out the fact that it is never revealed on the podcast that Tyler has a Confederate flag tattooed on him, you know, and that is only one fact that is not, I assume that there's dozens, if not hundreds of hours of recordings that we did not hear. I assume that there's lots of stuff left on the cutting room floor, especially considering this thing's like 7 hours.
Mm-hmm.
I assume that there's a ton that's not out there. And that's the thing, the thing that holds me back is from recommending it, even as a person who does not necessarily a big fan, is what else did they leave out?
But no piece of art is comprehensive. No piece of art can include every piece of context you could ever possibly need to evaluate something, or else every piece of art would be 1,000 hours long.
I mean, that's the thing. I'm fine with this if it's art, but I don't. That's the thing that keeps me from calling it journalism, because I think
journalism and art are mutually exclusive. I think a well-written profile is art. It is, you're reporting on somebody, but you're also illuminating them, and there is artistry in that.
I think that is too big a topic for this podcast.
We'll save that for our 78 part series of what is art.
Yeah. Oh my God. That's the thing. It's a larger encompassing question that I kept coming back to about this thing. It's like, what is it? But when you say, oh, is this valuable? I say yes, because I feel like it is it is pushing podcasts in a different direction. You know, it is expanding what they can be, and that's always interesting to me. Whenever any kind of art is expanding and becoming a different thing or pushing in a new direction, like, there were very few debates about oral literature before this. This came out published by NPR, and suddenly people are like, oh, well, podcasts are art now, huh? And while I resent the fact that there's thousands and there's over a million podcasts, I believe, officially now, a lot of them are also art. All of them are art, if you really want to be very lenient. But yes, bring attention. Yes, I'm fine with that. I want that. I want more people to listen to podcasts, more people to explore the genre, push for expansion, so to speak.
Agreed. I'm with you.
Is there anything else you wanted to bring up, Andrew?
Well, I just wanted to let your listeners know that you and I are going to open our own flower business, and I'm sure everything's going to go great.
That part, I was literally like, really? Really? A flower? What?
There's no business like flower business.
That man opened a flower shop? This... What did he do when people wanted a petunia? Don't you know that climate change is the worst thing? Oh my God, look at these tables.
You can easily see him being the comic book guy of a flower shop.
Yeah. When those ladies at the end, I think, yes, John is a very compelling man, but by the end of this thing, I was all right on board with everyone. It was like, we got tired of him talking about climate change. Yes, I understand. I agree with what he, I agree with how he feels about it, but he should watch Lisa the Vegetarian. Yeah, you're not
everybody good. Should.
So. Everyone, yeah, it's a good idea. If, yeah, don't, if you can espouse your beliefs without literally hammering in at people. Andrew, what's what? Where should people go to find your things on the internet?
If people would like to find my things on the internet, they should go to my website, which is theandrewblog.net. That's three words, theandrewblog.net. And you can also check out my writing on Consequence of Sounds, expanded TV and film coverage. And you can also find me on Twitter at theandrewblog. And thank you so much for having me, Robbie. Even if it's to force you to listen to a podcast that you at least have very conflicted feelings about.
It's. I'd listen to this again before I watched the first season of Discovery again.
I don't know if that's a high bar. That's they've changed showrunners again too, so we've got more drama in the offing.
That will make for a great season two, I'm sure. Having constantly changing leadership that never, I believe, that was a reason the first season's not so great. So I'm sure the second season will be off to a banging start with another new showrunner. Maybe not the last.
Maybe it's the cartoon theory where to correct somebody's amnesia, you need to whack them on the head again. Maybe it needed another showrunner change to like give it that jolt back into pure good.
Yeah, sure. Seems like
hope springs eternal. Robbie.
Yeah, I don't. Not for me. I'm not. I don't have a lot there.
You're the John B. McLemore on the quality of Star Trek Discovery.
Yeah, I'll believe it when I see it. Andrew, thank you for joining me.
My pleasure. Anytime.
Thanks again to Andrew for joining me. You can find me on Twitter at Robbie Dorman, and the show's website is serialfanaticist.com. You can follow our Facebook page at facebook.com/serialfanaticist. If you like the show, give it a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to it. Subscribe, tell your friends, word of mouth works. Greatly appreciated. I appreciate it. Thanks for taking the time. Until next time, thanks for being a fan.